Welcome to episode 144 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me for this podcast is Abir Mukherjee, who's A Necessary Evil, the second in his Wyndham Banerjee series, has recently been released in North America, as well as landing on the 2019 Edgar Award long list. The first in the series, A Rising Man, received an Edgar nomination for Best Novel this year. For those who like their crime fiction to take them to a different time and place, Abir's novels are ideal vehicles. In post-World War I Calcutta, India, Captain Wyndham, formerly of Scotland Yard, has joined the Calcutta Police Force, partnering with the Cambridge-educated Native Sergeant Surendranath Banerjee. Here's Abir Mukherjee to talk about A Necessary Evil. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. We're talking today to Abir Mukherjee, whose A Necessary Evil was just published in the United States, and who's here in New York attending the Edgars because his first novel, A Rising Man, was nominated for the 2018 Edgar. Welcome, Abir.
Hi, Nancy. It's an absolute honor to be here.
Oh, push.
It's true. I'm loving it. I'm loving not just this interview, but loving my time in the States. Wandering around New York, to me, feels a bit like being on a film set. and I've got soundtracks to films going through my head as I walk down the street. It's wonderful.
I have a lot of questions, but my first has to be, you have a real job. So what made you decide to write crime fiction, and why did you choose the time and place, which is post-World War I Calcutta, that you did?
Well, that's a great question, Nancy. I think, to be honest with you, it's because of my real job that I decided to write. My day job is I'm an accountant, which is very, very boring, and I was having a midlife crisis, and I thought to myself, is there more to life than accounting? I was rather hoping there would be. I really had this idea that, you know, it was either that, or either writing or buying a Harley Davidson, and I'm a bit of a coward. So I took to writing. And, I'd always wanted to write, but I'd never had the confidence. And then I saw an interview with Lee Child on Breakfast TV in the UK, and he said how at the age of 40 he'd packed in his job and he'd started writing. And I'd never read any Lee Child, any of Lee's work before. So I picked up his first novel, Killing Floor, and I really enjoyed it. And what struck me was just how simply it was written, but just how good the plot was. And that's really what gave me confidence to start writing. Why this period and why crime fiction? I'm a reader of many genres of fiction, but I've always considered sort of crime to be the genre that I read the most of. I wouldn't call it a guilty pleasure, it's just a pleasure. And so when it came to writing, it felt natural to write a crime novel. And why India and why this period? Well, my parents came from India. They came from Calcutta, and they came to Britain in the 60s. And so, you know, the period of British rule in India, I think, is a very important period in both British and Indian history, but also as part of world history. And I felt that, you know, in Britain, we tend to brush that history under the carpet, or we tend to look at it through rose-tinted specs. And similarly, the Indians tend to airbrush that period in history as well. They tend to romanticize it. And, you know, growing up between both of those cultures, neither the story that's told in British schools or the story that's told in India really rang true to me. And so I really wanted to explore that period in history. But I didn't want to write a history book because I wanted people to read it. and so writing a crime novel with a British detective going out to India, joining up with an Indian sergeant, really to look at the history of the 1920s and 30s in that period, but through the eyes of these two men, seemed like an interesting way to go.
And when did you realize that your story of Captain Wyndham, who is the recently of Scotland Yard, your detective who's come from England, and Sergeant Banerjee of the Calcutta Police Force, when did you realize it would become a series?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I'd never written anything before. I'd wanted to write. I'd always sort of harbored this ambition. And I would start writing and I would write a chapter or something and I would, you know, make the mistake of reading it or, you know, or life just getting in the way. You know, we all have families and day jobs and sometimes you just don't have the time to do things. And I would just put it to the back of a drawer and forget about it. And the same thing might have happened this time. I'd written 10,000 words of this first book, A Rising Man, where Sam goes out, you know, he's a veteran of the First World War, and he's a damaged individual, and he goes to Calcutta mainly because it's slightly preferable to suicide. I'd written about 10,000 words, and again, I'd made that mistake of reading those 10,000 words and losing all confidence in my abilities, and I put it in a drawer, and this time it would have probably stayed in the drawer if it hadn't been for a stroke of luck. I saw a competition advertised in one of our national newspapers run by Penguin Random House, and they were looking for new crime writers, and all you needed was the first 5,000 words of a novel and a two-page synopsis. And that appealed to me because I am naturally lazy, and I'd already done the work. So I tidied up the first 5,000 words and wrote a two-page synopsis over the space of, I think, a fortnight. And then I sent it away, and I didn't really think much about it. I was hoping for some sort of feedback. And then 3 months later, I get an email saying, congratulations, you've won, and we're going to publish your novel. Except I didn't have a novel. I had these 10,000 rotten words in a drawer somewhere. But that really was the beginning of the journey.
Both of your main... Well, that's a wonderful story, and I think... should give confidence to people who are writing, and the other,
absolutely.
The other thing about that too is, I think as a writer, you not necessarily want to go back and read your first 10,000 words. Most writers I talk to say, just get it out there, and you can
absolutely
always go back and fix it.
That is some of the best advice you can give writers who are starting out, which is, you know, don't go back. Get it all down on the page and then fix it, as you say. I mean, and there are several reasons for that. One is the confidence factor. You know, if you're anything like me, you know, reading what you write is a very difficult and cringeworthy process. And I lack confidence even today in what I write. And this is 5 years later. But more so, I think when you go back and you read over things, you also lose a bit of the impetus, a bit of the drive that's pushing you forward. But you're absolutely right. The way to write is to just get it down, and then you can fix it.
The characters that you created, though, you've got two main characters, which is sort of a well-worn trope of mystery fiction, and I don't say that in any critical way because it works. But I wanted to start with Surrender Not Banerjee. When I read A Rising Man, it was in my mystery book club, and one member is an Indian woman, and she was appalled that his first name, which she explained is not at all unusual in India, actually a beautiful name, was rendered in that way. And so I have to ask you, why did Banerjee put up with it?
Well, I'll tell you the truth behind that name. I found it in a book, a history book from about 70 years ago. There was a gentleman called Surendranath Banerjee who was actually knighted by the British, but they couldn't pronounce his name. They called him Surendranot. And if you actually look at the text, he is known as Sir Surendranot Banerjee. But that was life in that period. You know, that was the dynamic between colonial master and the governed, the native governed people. You didn't have a choice. If the Englishman decided that was the title they were going to bestow upon you, there was very little you could do about it if you wanted to work with them and for them. And the thing is that the middle classes, especially those of Calcutta and Bengal, were really co-opted into the colonial machinery. So if you look at the Indian civil service, the top ranks were all white, but the vast majority of people that worked in the administrative services were Indian, and mainly Bengali, because Bengal and Calcutta were the first area that the British really settled in. Calcutta was the capital, and Bengalis were the first recipients of mass Western education. So the Bengali middle class formed the backbone of this, of the middle-ranking administration. And their superiors were the British, and the British had a very haughty attitude to their subordinates, whether they were, you know, natives or actually working-class people from Britain. You know, there was a hierarchy, but, you know, there was very little you could do about it.
That was one of the most interesting points for me, was that Sergeant Banerjee had actually been to Cambridge, and Captain Wyndham, who is a white guy, was, you know, from a sort of a second-rate primary school, and as far as I know, did not go to university. So that to me was a really interesting sort of, you know, social dynamic, ethnic social dynamic that Banerjee is obviously, first of all, he's a Brahmin, so among Indians, he's in the top caste, and yet he's not thought of as Sam Wyndham's superior in education or anything, because he's not English.
Absolutely, and that's the impact I was going for. And these things did happen. You did have, you know, the scions of wealthy Indian families who tended to be upper caste because, you know, they tended to have the wealth anyway, who would go off to study in England. And a lot of these families, you have to remember, in the 18th century in particular, in the 19th century, a lot of these families were Anglophile. You know, the relationship between the British and the Indians evolved over time, and it soured over time. But there was a time when, you know, these families, rich native families, did, you know, ape the educational and the Western values of the British, and they would send their sons to Oxford and Cambridge to study. The irony is that, as you say, in this situation, they would come back, but they are still subordinate to people just because of the colour of their skin. And that, to me, was a very, very interesting dynamic, and it's one that was actually there at the time. It's not something that I made up. It's the dynamic between the governing and the governed is something that really was one of the central points of why I wanted to write the book. What I wanted to really understand was, you know, how does a moral Christian people justify the, you know, domination and oppression of another race? How do they justify that to themselves? And what I found was that a lot of that came down to this idea of moral superiority. The British had to justify to themselves their role in India, and the way they did that was that they said they were there on a civilizing mission. They were there doing the work of God. But very often you would find that once on the ground, the British who were there realized that this wasn't the case. And you had a lot of very unhappy colonial officials, and you know, and it affected them mentally. And really, what I wanted to look at was the effect of empire, not just on the Indians, but on the governing classes as well, because I think we've forgotten that.
Well, you tell the story. The narration is first person, and it's from Captain Wyndham's point of view, and I can understand that because you're bringing him from London to Calcutta, and we can discover Calcutta along with him. But I want to know about Sam Wyndham and where he came from in your imagination. As you mentioned, he's a World War I vet. Like many World War I vets, he's damaged. He's addicted to opium. And that reminded me, I don't know if you've seen Berlin Babylon on television, but it also has a World War I veteran on the other side, a German, also addicted to opium. And where did Sam Wyndham come from in your imagination, and how did he bubble up and become your voice in this book, in these books?
Well, I mean, I think there's two things that you asked there, and I think they're both fascinating questions. I think, firstly, in terms of why did I decide to write it from the point of view of the Englishman as opposed to the Indian? As you rightly say, we discover Calcutta alongside Sam. But there were another couple of reasons. I suppose from a purely sort of mechanical level, an Indian wouldn't have had access to all levels of society that a white person would have, a white policeman would have at that period. So I had to write it from the point of view of the white protagonist. But to be quite honest with you, the main reason I wrote it from the point of view of Sam rather than Surrender Not or an Indian was I didn't feel confident enough that I could write it from an Indian's perspective. You know, I felt confident writing it from an Englishman's perspective because I'd grown up in Britain my whole life. I'm born and raised in Britain. And though I'm of Indian origin and I speak Bengali and I understand the culture, I didn't feel confident enough to write it from an Indian's perspective. And I don't know what you might want to read into that, but that's firstly why I wrote it from the point of view of Sam. In terms of why how Sam came about, to be honest with you, I mean, Sam and Surrender Not both represent different parts of me. Sam, I like to think of Sam as, you know, the first of that generation of modern men. He's been through the war, and the war has opened his eyes to the fact that not everything he's told by his superiors is true. And he comes out of that quite cynical. And that, to be honest with you, that sort of mirrors, I think, what a lot of people go through, especially if you grew up as a child of immigrants in a different culture. You learn very, very early on that there are two sides to every story. So I would go to school and I would learn something in history class and I would come back and my father would say, that's not right. And half the time he was right and half the time he was wrong. But what you realize very early on is that what you're taught or what you're told by people in authority isn't necessarily the case. And I think Sam embodies that cynicism, that unwillingness, or that willingness to look beyond what he's told by his superiors. And for me, that was very important. I needed Sam to be jaded. I couldn't have him just swallowing the party line or the British line on everything. I wanted Sam to look at things in the way that a modern person would. Also, I think Sam, like me, and actually like Surrender Not as well, is a fish out of water, as many of the best detectives are, because he can see things outside of the normal frame of things. And, you know, being the child of immigrants, to a large extent, I am a fish out of water as well. There's nowhere that I feel 100% as though I fit in. You know, I was born in London. I grew up in Scotland. My parents are of Indian origin. But I don't feel 100% at home in Scotland or London or India. I'm sort of a part of that generation of people who are one of all of these things, but never fully of any one of them.
Well, I'd like to think that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts in your case.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's not something I'd want to change, but what it does give you is it gives you more than one perspective, and I wanted Sam to have that. Similarly, Surrender Not is almost a fish out of water. He is, okay, he's Bengali, and he is from, the upper caste. But he's, he's studied in England, he's educated there, and he's working for the colonial authorities. So he's not completely a member of his own society. And as time goes on, he becomes ostracized by, his family and those of his community. So both of them really are fish out of water. And there's a third character who I'd sort of possibly call one of the central characters, which is Annie Grant, who is, one of the characters in the first book and whom Sam falls for. she too is in many ways a fish out of water. She's an Anglo-Indian, so, you know, she's of that group of people who, you know, generations earlier would have married with Indians and produced offspring that were neither British or Indian, and they've become a community of their own. But they're neither one thing or the other. They're not recognised as Indian and they're not recognised as British. And I think between the three of them, I think they look at things from different perspectives, but they also mirror my own sort of feelings, which is you never take things at face value. I think Sam also has a bit of my sort of Glaswegian gallows humour about him. And when you grow up in the west of Scotland where it rains an awful lot, you develop that sort of sense of humour. And I think Sam has that. And Surrendernot has my Indian chicken legs. So there's a bit of me in all of them.
And, of course, Sam also has a love of scotch, which...
Absolutely, absolutely. took a lot of experimenting to find the right one, but it was time well spent.
Absolutely. The locales of your first novel, A Rising Man, stuck pretty close to Calcutta. In A Necessary Evil, Wyndham and Banerjee travel to one of the princely states in the state of Orissa. Please correct me if I'm mispronouncing.
I think you're pronouncing it spot on.
Which is southwest of Calcutta. So when you decided to take the story on the road, as it were you worried that you might break some readers' brains with the need to understand the history, specifically that English rule in India was not monolithic, and geography? And my follow-up question to that would be, if you were concerned with the UK readership, did the idea of a North American reader, specifically an American reader, because we're not known for our grasp of either history or geography, did that freak you out?
I think you're trying to break my brain with these questions, Natalie. No, to be honest with you, to me it was a fascinating thing. You know, we all have this view of the Maharajas. We all know about them, and they were the richest men in the world in their day. They were the equivalent of the Arab sheikhs. And I knew I wanted to write about, that period in history and the princely states. In terms of the geography, yeah, it fascinated me. The fact, and I didn't know this, you know, the fact is that these were supposedly independent kingdoms where British rule didn't run. At the same time, the rulers couldn't leave, you know, Greater India without the permission of the viceroy. And they had very little power outside of their own kingdoms, but they were extremely wealthy. So it fascinated me, and I really wanted to write about them. In terms of the geography, to be honest, I wasn't that concerned about where to set it. I have great faith in my readers, both in Britain and in North America. I'm sure, people who would want to read my book are probably interested in India anyway. And I think what I've learned is that, you know, readers have an avid wish to learn about new things. They want to be challenged. They want to learn more about things. And I think that's the sort of reader that I love, and I would hope that this would appeal to them. In terms of the princely state itself, so just to backtrack, in the second book, there's the assassination of the crown prince of one of these states, and Sam and Surrendernot were on the scene and failed to stop the assassination, but they go on the trail of the assassins. And that leads them back to the princely state of Sambalpur. And Sambalpur was really an interesting place. I chose it simply by looking down a list of princely states that had existed, but hadn't existed at the time when I wrote the book. So Sambalpur had existed up to about the 1700s, so the early 1800s, but it hadn't existed in 1920. It was already part of British India. But as I did more research on the place, it met a lot of the other things that I wanted to talk about. So I wanted to talk about certain things about Hindu religion. I wanted to look at, you know, diamonds and other things. And Sambalpur had it all. So it just seemed the ideal place to set this novel. To be honest with you, the real reason that I wanted to write about the princely states once I started doing my research was the role of women in these states, and that's something that fascinated me, and it's something I think we've misunderstood all this time.
Well, actually, you are anticipating one of my later questions, and so I'm going to skip ahead to that one.
Oh, well, I'll slow down.
Because you mentioned Annie Grant, and you know that was part of the wheels were coming off the bus of English rule after World War I. You know, the English Raj was coming unglued. They were holding on, and you know, as we're looking through Sam's eyes into this crumbling colonialism, you know, the same sort of, you know, racial and religious bias between and among all the groups in the novel, the English, the Bengali, the Hindu, and Muslim, were depressingly familiar to anyone that reads the news today. And the idea of mixed-race individuals, which were, from Annie's point of view, are, as she explains this to Sam, are shunned by both communities, both Indian and English. It reminded me that societies hadn't come as far as perhaps we should have. And then the women, you know, Annie, you know, all the women in A Necessary Evil are remarkable. But one of the things that struck me was Sam Wyndham is not immune to this discomfort at the thought of an English, you know, Rita, a white woman involved with an Indian man, even though he was a prince. So, I mean, that's, yes, I'm throwing a whole bunch of spaghetti on the wall here for you to
Let's just pick up a couple of things. Yeah, in terms of the women, as I say, when I started planning the second novel, I knew I wanted to set it in a princely state simply because it was such a colourful period and these were such colourful characters. The Maharajas would think nothing of, you know, filling their swimming pools with Dom Perignon to celebrate the birth of a child, as long as it was a boy. And you know, they would have these huge harems, and they would marry only, you know, the highest caste of princesses. But then they would come to London and fall in love with a trapeze artist or a chiropodist's assistant, and then, you know, offer to make them a princess and take them back to the middle of nowhere to these, you know, fabulous palaces. So it was a very interesting period in history. But what quickly dawned on me when I was doing my research was, as I say, the role of women in these princely states, because we tend to concentrate on the Maharajas and we think of the women as being locked up in the harems or the zenanas, and as being quite submissive. But what I found was that, you know, on many occasions it was the women who, from the privacy or the seclusion of the zenana or the harem, held a lot of political and economic power in these countries in their own right. And I suppose the greatest example of that is a kingdom called Bhopal, which for 100 years, and Bhopal was the place, I don't know if you remember, there was a Union Carbide factory.
Yeah, the terrible explosion and poisoning of thousands of people.
That's right. But that was 100 years ago, that was a separate country or a princely state. But for over 100 years, it was ruled openly by women, and not just Hindu women, but Muslim women. Which, you know, to me was quite surprising given our views of you know, Islam and the conservatism that we associate with it. You know, the fact is that 150 years ago, you know, Muslim women were running countries quite openly. And that, to me, was fascinating. So I was really, really, you know, surprised at the role of women. And all, as you say, all of the women in the book, or three or four of the major characters in the book that are women in the second book, are all very, very powerful women. And you know, Annie is one. There's a school teacher. There's one of the Maharanis. And what fascinated me was just that the roles that these women were fulfilling in that period, and it's something that I think we've forgotten.
And they do make great characters. You know, women. As you said, you know, and that's part of being, you know, historically challenged. Everybody is. You tend to forget that, you know.
Well, we've whitewashed women from history. That's the problem. History has been written from a very, you know, male-centric perspective. And you know, when you when you dig beneath the surface, you realize, you know, just the color that is there and the role of women. And, you know, as a writer, it's sort of beholden upon me to at least make people think about these things, you know, if not to properly set the record straight.
Well, you know what they say, history is written by the winners.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I see that you have your third Wyndham and Banerjee book coming out, Smoke and Ashes, in the UK. So can you tell us a little bit about what's next for this dynamic duo?
Sure. As you know, the first book is set in 1919. The second book moves on to 1920. And being an accountant, I knew the third book had to be 1921. And we see Sam and Surrender Not back in Calcutta. And it's the final few weeks of the year. It's December 1921. And that was a very interesting period in history, because 1921 was the year Gandhi started his first non-violent, non-cooperation movement in India. And it was the first time that it became a mass movement. So Gandhi effectively said at the beginning of the year, if you give me non-violent, non-cooperation, I will give you independence by the end of the year. So essentially the whole country came out on strike. And it was a war of attrition. So you had people resigning from the government, Indians resigning from the police force. But it was, as I say, a war of attrition, because like any strike, if you're not working, you're not getting paid. If you're not getting paid, you can't feed your family. So, you know, over time, people drifted back to work, or other people took their place. And there was a lot of tension. You know, it was a very difficult year on both sides. And now we're getting into the final month of that year. And the British government decided to send the Prince of Wales, who was Prince Edward, who then married Wallace Simpson later on when he became king. They sent him to India on a goodwill mission. So he is, you know, set to arrive in Calcutta on Christmas Day. So that is the background and the backdrop to the novel. There's all this tension going on, and you have the Prince of Wales making his way to Calcutta to arrive on Christmas Day. In amongst all of that, Sam's opium addiction is getting worse. The novel starts with him in an opium den witnessing a murder. But he can't tell anybody about this murder because he's in an opium den. And then when a separate murder occurs, which seems very, very similar in terms of the wounds, etc., he's put in a very difficult position. He doesn't know who to trust or who to tell that there might be a serial killer out there. And so that's really the background to book three.
So it starts with a conundrum, and it ends with the Prince of Wales. That sounds perfect.
Yes, yes. And I've been told it's the best one so far, mainly because it's the shortest. It's a good 10,000 words shorter than the others.
Well, Abir, thank you so much for your time and for
it's
talking to us.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Nancy. Thank you so much.